Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. And, you know, it's a lazy Sunday the week after Thanksgiving, and I, for one, am really glad that there's not a mouth-watering cookbook in front of me right now with the author tantalizing me with all the details because I just overate. So instead, I'm talking with the lovely author, Eve Turow, in the station. Hi. And she has written a really great academic study about food. And it's called A Taste of Generation Yum, How the Millennial Generation's Love for Organic Fare, Celebrity Chefs, and Microbrews Will Make or Break the Future of Food.
Yep. It is a mouthful.
Well, thanks for joining us here, Eve.
Yeah, and
thank you so much for writing this book. I gotta say, you did so much research to come to these conclusions, whereas a lot of the times, like, I have these like anecdotal like observations that I wish I could prove.
Yep. Well, so that's pretty much how I felt. And so I had this overarching question, you know, living in New York City especially, mm-hmm. seeing how food is now a new form of social currency. People are talking about chefs and restaurants. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, well, why the heck are all of these recession-dented young people spending their discretionary income on food?
Mm-hmm.
And the like, you know, conversations I was having with friends really was just an impetus to dig a little bit deeper and see what kind of research did exist, mm-hmm. and also continuing to have those conversations with other people.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because similar to kind of when I was starting to write a food blog back in 2006, I was at first really fascinated about all the conversation about restaurants and chefs, and I was totally in it. And then I was like, why am I spending so much money on restaurants? And then I started to look about like all the details about where food is coming from, how it's made. And this is kind of like it sounds like that's where you took your research with the book too.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, for a lot of journalists or, you know, creative nonfiction writers, it's a little selfish always, you know, your research, if you're going to get into something enough to want to write a book about it, you have to be personally invested.
And literally that's, hungry for it.
Yeah. Yeah. It became a bizarre obsession. I thought it was going to be an article. And then as I continued to dig and learn, I just got more and more interested and kept kind of unraveling these complexities about our generation that it ended up getting into more of a psychological, emotional space that I hadn't really anticipated.
Wow. So you found that, well, first and foremost, that today's youngsters or millennials are more obsessed with food than ever. And you attribute that sort of to media and what else?
Yeah. I mean, so on the surface, right, there's a few things that you think of when you think of millennials. You think of broke, right? So we graduated for the most part.
Debt,
$1 trillion in student loan debt in the United States. We don't really trust our government institutions. And that's around the world. Like, you're seeing that even with like the Arab Spring or in Europe with the recession there. So it's not just a U.S. specific thing. But we're also the first generation that's grown up in the technological space.
Right.
So we're
access to info.
Yeah. And so when people think of millennials, they think of us as narcissistic and lazy and in debt. But the truth is that, you know, there's a lot more to us that makes us a unique subject to study, and also as a sign of everything that's to come. Mm-hmm. You know, we grew up with one foot in, one foot out of the technological boom. So I grew up learning the Dewey Decimal System in the library. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you know, I had my typing class and learned how to make, you know, a baller PowerPoint presentation. Right. And so now people are lamenting the
effect. Yeah.
not in my world, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyone who does any pitches or anything in ad world
decks,
now. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Everything is still PowerPoint, which surprises me. Honestly,
yeah,
it's like,
weird.
Right.
Yeah.
We didn't get past that. but so it really surprised me just how directly correlated our relationship with food is to the rise in technology, and almost like an emotional reaction to being constantly connected to our devices instead of being connected to one another, or some of the most basic things about what makes us human, which is, you know, where our food comes from mm-hmm. and how we eat.
Yeah, I'm trying to like figure out how that leap comes, because I know that, you know, you mentioned early on that it's like there's a lot of Instagramming of food and like kind of fetishizing it as this commercial like thing, an obsession.
Yeah.
But that somehow, you're saying that somehow leads to like a deeper emotional connection.
Well, so there's a lot of different elements at play. So one of it is that at the beginning I thought, well, are we really so narcissistic? Everyone says that about mm-hmm. us, right?
The selfie,
Yeah. And after 4 years of research, I can say, yes, we are that narcissistic. but I don't really blame us for it, because we've grown up in this time where self-branding is everything,
uh-huh.
right? You need to brand yourself like in a specific way on OkCupid to get a date, a different way on LinkedIn to get a job, a different mm-hmm. way on Facebook to show your friends how great you are. And we are thinking about ourselves and the way that we represent ourselves all the time.
Right.
So as a kid, it's not just about what you're wearing to school. It's about what you've posted on your Instagram account or what someone has commented on your account. And you're thinking about yourself all the time. And now that food has become imbued with all of these other labels, like organic, fair trade, anything like that, the minute that you take a picture of it and place it online, it becomes a part of your personal brand, and it becomes a representation of your values.
Wow. I never thought, I mean, it's very true that, you know, we identify that food is what you eat is like the oldest like adage in the world.
Even online.
Even online. But do you think that young, I guess I'm a millennial, but I'm an old one. but do you think that we care more about the perception of like being, I guess, a good eater and good Samaritan rather than
reality? That's like my main worry. So like I came at this, I think, from honestly a pretty superficial standpoint at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I was just like, I want to understand why I'm taking pictures of food, or why I bother talking to my friends about the latest restaurant openings.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of my research, started to get a little depressed, because I started to pay more attention to things like climate change or the farm bill and farm subsidies and, you know, food policy actually for the farm workers. And at the end of the book, I call Michael Pollan,
mm-hmm.
Who is, of course, fascinating and interesting and knows so much on this topic, and really said to him, like, is our interest just on a surface level, or will this generation kind of take up the torch also of food policy, not just, you know, pork belly bao and ramen, to really change the food system? Like, will this passion ever translate into something bigger?
Okay. What did he say?
Well, you know, he said he wasn't sure, and then he said it was possible. So, you know, we had a pretty in-depth conversation about it. And, you know, of course, if anyone's super interested, you can read the book on it. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, really he started talking about the complexities of the food movement and the fact that we're going to need more of like a cohesive theme
mm-hmm.
for millennials to kind of latch onto. And my main conclusion, honestly, from it was that if we want to make food policy something that's going to become as popular as David Chang,
right,
then we're going to have to make it something that millennials want
to
make a part of their personal brand.
Mm-hmm. Where, so like, true.
If there's something like food waste, I think is going to be huge in 2016. Mm-hmm. And part of that's going to be because Dan Barber has made it cool. Roy Choi is making it cool.
I love that. Yeah, those waste dinners.
Yeah, yeah. And like, it's, you can totally pin like a recipe for cauliflower stems.
I guess so. It sounds like we're more motivated by what's cool than what's really scary and important and urgent and needs to get done.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole world, like, climate change is really hard to grasp. Right, because it's like, it's completely intangible. It's happening at such a slow rate.
And it's also a little depressing. I know. Yeah. You can like dabble in it and look at some, you know, the first paragraph of some stories and then just really throw your hands up.
Right. And then you're like, oh my God, should I even bother having kids? I mean, that's, you know, like, what world are we going to...
I've heard that.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the amazing things about food, and this is really a core theme of my book, is that it puts us in the driver's seat. Mm. So we're a generation that really feels out of control in so many ways. We don't feel like we have control over necessarily the environment, over politics, over whether or not we can get a job. We don't trust our technologies, right? We're in this whole other era of not really understanding anything around us. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't really know how the internet works. I don't know if I've been hacked or not. I don't know if someone's posted something nasty about me. I don't understand like how so many of the gadgets in my kitchen work. There's so many intangibles.
Yeah.
But food puts us back in the driver's seat. And that's also why you're seeing this call today for
labeling. Yeah.
Labeling, right. Mm-hmm. People want to know what's in their food. They want labels that are very simple. They want to get to know their farmers. They want to start to form relationships. And it's almost like this backwards regression. So in some ways, I think if you can amplify food policy in some way that is emphasizing relationship building, mm-hmm. putting you back in control of your environment and what you eat, then I really think that it could become, you know, the major movement of our generation. You know, our parents had the civil rights movement. I really do think that food policy could become ours.
Absolutely. And with like all the revelations of how much the food system has changed too with industrialization and globalization, which you notice that like there is that need for control that I find like a lot of people take to the, you know, grocery store aisles and so forth.
So the levels of anxiety and depression, I think, among our generation was really, I didn't think that this research was going to take me there. And it turns out that our relationship with food is really directly related to that kind of psychological stance that we're in right now.
So interesting. We're going to talk a lot more about these insights, and we're just going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude and be right back.
Ever wonder where your Christmas tree came from? Now you don't have to. New York State-grown Christmas trees are now available in New York City. Trees grown on farms here in New York State are harvested just a few days before arriving to the city. Trees cut close to home stay fresh longer. And trees cut close to home travel less, which reduces fuel consumption of delivery vehicles. Did you know that buying a real tree helps to sustain agriculture in New York State? By supporting local farmers and keeping important open space in agriculture production, the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York is partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets in Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan. So when you shop local this holiday season, you can include the tree in that list. For more information and a full list of locations, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org.
Hello, I'm Alice Marcus Creek.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we're the ladies of We Dig Plants. And today we're asking you to dig deep into your pockets and help us grow this radio station and our podcast and everything that you know and love about us.
How do you do it? You go to the heritageradionetwork.org website. You will see a beating heart. It's on every page. And you can give a dollar, you can give $5, you can give whatever.
$500.
$500, $5,000. Just click on the heart, donate, and help support the radio that you love.
All right, we're back chatting with Eve Turow, the author of A Taste of Generation Yum. Thanks so much for joining us. So it sounds to me like, you know, when you first delved into this research, food is sort of a gateway to so many other facets about our modern culture. Is that what you felt?
Yeah, for sure. And so, you know, a lot of people look at this book and they say, oh, you wrote about food culture. And it's like, well, no, I really looked at the millennial generation through the lens of food. You know, our parents use their discretionary income on drugs and rock and roll. And we're using that money on, like, truffle cheese.
Yeah, you know.
So it makes sense to really, you know, dig into a generation by looking at where we're spending our extra time and our extra money, especially when we should be saving it to pay rent or, you know, move out of our parents' houses or something like that.
I mean, it has reached an all-time high. Do you see this as like a trend that might wane, or what do you think is the next food or rock and roll or drug?
No, I mean, that's a really, it's a really good question. So the reason that food, according to me, has become the passion of this generation is because it's satisfying four distinct things for us, which is it's giving us a little bit more control.
Okay.
It's something tangible.
Mm-hmm.
It engages all of our senses, so sensory stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's also encouraging of community.
Yeah, so, social, recreational.
Right, okay. Right. But there's several things. I call this like the anti-technology. There's several things that can be the anti-technology. So you're also seeing a rise in like adult coloring books.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
That's so that's true. Knitting, too.
Yeah. And like the whole maker movement. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of that is about like creating something that actually, I mean, think about if you meet someone nowadays and they're like, yeah, I'm a furniture maker or I'm a plumber or like, it's like, whoa.
You make
like,
things.
You can actually
cool.
do something.
And you probably wear overalls. And,
yeah. But there's something like really like sexy and, you know, exciting
totally.
About that kind of tangible item or, you know, so it's possible that something else will arise that satisfies those needs for this generation. That said, I think it's really exciting right now to see what's happening even with Gen Zers or digital natives, whatever. You know, this step younger is experiencing because they are engaging with food in a way that no generation has before.
They have so much media about food.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's the media that's already there, right? But they're also growing up with parents who are already aware of organics and maybe are cooking it. Dinner at home a little bit more. Like, I grew up with a lot of processed food. I mean, my mom loved to cook, but I still, you know, ate SpaghettiOs.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and had tacos made with taco spice mix packets and stuff like that. And, you know, if a lot of the theories in my book maintain their veracity, then as people's lives become even more infused with technology, their craving for something that is the absolute opposite of that is going to continue.
You know, this must be very chilling for, like, the major food conglomerate corporations right now. I mean, already they're suffering, you know, McDonald's is losing profits like crazy.
Big Food is really going to have to shift in a really significant way in order to maintain its footing. And that's because you're seeing kind of the simmering of a new food movement, of an alternate food movement. And it's possible that if Big Food does not take charge, that there is something else that could come up and replace them. That said, I am relying in some way on Big Food to make these changes, to save the food movement in a lot of different ways.
And how successful do you think, or do you know, the like attempts to sort of slap an organic label on something? And I know that they comply with whatever that means, but like, say, like, you know, organic Doritos, like, is that working now?
Well, so it's really interesting. So the book came out, my book came out in July. The response to it has been much bigger than I had anticipated. And part of the response that I hadn't expected was big food companies who are now reaching out and saying, you know, what should we be doing? Which is great. So, like, you know, I have a sounding board and can talk to people at that level. But a lot of the conversations are about, you know, not just making the organic Dorito. It's about almost shifting like a profile entirely or brand profile entirely. But there was actually, there was a great piece in the New York Times recently about Unilever that's trying to make this shift. And part of it is, right, what is sustainable? Sustainability doesn't have an overarching definition. So then
the criteria,
So you can kind of skirt around it in different ways. And the other part of it is that big food took, you know, decades to grow. And now they have these processes for distribution, the relationship with their farmers. And in order to change a product, it requires a shifting of so many different pieces and parts for these companies that have, you know, 300,000 employees.
Trying to,
But it doesn't mean it's impossible. And these larger food companies are starting to understand the ramifications of not delivering on what this millennial generation wants and needs, because we have, there's so many of us and we have such an amazing spending power. And this food trend is not US specific. So this is happening in India. This is happening in China, in Spain, in Australia, in New Zealand.
Well, for sure, because there's a lot of food, you know, toxic scares around the world too, and safety issues, I guess.
But it's almost any developed city. You're seeing young people creating awesome new food delivery apps or even like the Blue Apron concept that started in Europe. And now there is even a version of it in China.
There's tons.
So it's really exciting. And I am actually optimistic.
So, I mean, what do you think Big Food is going to do? Acquire smaller companies?
That's part of it. So you're already seeing that happen, right? General Mills bought Annie's. Organic last year. Unilever, I think, has started buying up smaller. I was thinking that they were bought Hampton Creek, but they didn't. They sued Hampton Creek.
I remember that.
They did the opposite. That was a really bad PR move on their part.
Spat.
But I do think that these smaller companies are good. Oh, Ben and Jerry's got bought. Not that that's organic.
Cashews bought a while ago.
So I think that that's part of it. I do think that actual farming practices are starting to change. So in Iowa, the farmers themselves are taking it upon themselves to start to
implement.
They're understanding the importance of utilizing cover crops and other things that are going to reduce the amount of herbicide and pesticide.
That's great.
One of the biggest things I think that young people can be doing today that they're not necessarily is bringing up the farm bill as a voting issue. So we now have the presidential debates happening. It's, you know, kind of a sticky subject because there are so many farmers in the U.S., especially in Iowa. But the way that we subsidize certain crops in the U.S. could shift big food immensely. So right now,
so if we just mobilize.
I mean, I've heard from big food that if they wanted to go all organic, there aren't enough organic farms in the United States to be producing what they'd want to produce.
Right. And you hear that a lot.
And so, the, you know, what controls that is the government saying, we'll support organic farmers, we'll subsidize you, we'll cover you, almost give you like a crop insurance if your crop fails. So right now they do that for corn and soybean farmers.
So what can we do? So how do we, spread the word about the farm bill? So we like demand it, you know, to make it an...
A great website is actually pioneered by Tom Colicchio, chef.
Wonderful.
Called Food Policy Action.
Oh, right. Okay.
I highly recommend you go check out Food Policy Action. They give every congressman and senator a rating based on how they've voted on food policy. I would say any of these future... Right, we have a whole year left ahead of these presidential debates. You know, they're now taking questions on Twitter and on Facebook. I say, you know, log online whenever those are happening and just... get as many tweets out as possible that are about food that will hopefully force these major media networks to actually ask those questions. If they realize that that's a question we want answered, then they're going to address it.
All right. Keep asking. And then hopefully, so I guess the effect is that once these, I guess, farming practices are feasible, then the larger companies can comply. Cool. I forgot what I was going to say next. This is really, really exciting. And I guess that's about all the time we have today. But thank you so much for joining us, Eve. And I'm really excited to, you know, have something to hold and say, you know, this generation is really thinking about food a lot more deep. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Excellent work. We'll see everyone next week on Eat Your Words. You took it so slow. And now I've been so satisfied. No, I ain't never, 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 never had no loving like this before. Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.